The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Well, thank you all. It is a great honor for me to be here. I've visited this campus once just to walk through and take a look, and you know, that was a pleasure and honor, but it's a very great honor to address you all, speak to you. And I want to thank Christopher for being such a good sport on this little tour that we're doing from New York to Philly to D.C. tomorrow. We've had a grand old time thus far, and I'm very grateful for the whole thing. In the introduction, it said that Christopher read philosophy at Oxford. I tried to read philosophy at the University of Idaho, and I remember one time sitting in the library reading aloud just to maintain forward motion. In one of the various classes that I've taught or instructed at Logos School and New St. Andrews, one of the things I've done, one of the classes I've taught is classical rhetoric. And at New St. Andrews, and one of the things that they teach you in classical rhetoric is that persuasion is not just argumentation and reason, the logos, but it's also pathos, an emotive appeal, and ethos, your situation, your character, and what you can do to persuade an audience that you're for real. And so one of the things I wanted to do to establish my ethos at the beginning is... And you will know, if I feel like I'm starting to lose the debate, I will put this on. Of course, one of the things that we've been talking about, and each element of this triad will come up probably every time Christopher and I talk. It did in New York, and it will probably certainly do so tonight, and then on to... D.C. is the ancient triad of truth, goodness, and beauty. Truth, goodness, and beauty. One of the things I wanted to focus on this evening was beauty, but not because the other two things are irrelevant, and those certainly can come up in the questions or in our exchanges. But the way I want to argue, the way I want to talk about this, is that the Bible and God is not something that I'm interested in reasoning my way to. I don't believe that Christopher and I could find common ground, agree upon the rules of historical investigation, or agree upon the laws of logic, and then reason our way to God. There are many Christian apologists who believe that that is possible to do. I don't reject evidences, but I'm not an evidentialist. I believe that evidences have their place in apologetics, but I don't believe that they should be foundational. What I'm interested in doing is asking about the preconditions for any sort of statement. So in a debate, I think it's necessary to do two things for those who are observing the debate. What is necessary to do is not only look at what the person is saying, what argument is coming out of him, what is he articulating, but also take a look at his feet. What is he standing on in order to make that sort of statement? In other words, I would like to invite you to ask not only to hear what Christopher says about what he believes about the nature of the world, but then ask yourself, well, if he's correct and the world really is that way, would he be able to make that statement? All right, does any sort of statement follow that's rationally coherent from his assumption of the way the world is? Put simply, if the universe is time and chance acting on matter, if the universe, if the cosmos is simply matter in motion, then everything I think, feel, respond to is also matter in motion. If the universe, if the cosmos is matter in motion, then this table is matter in motion, and what's going on in my head is matter in motion.
With love.
What's that?
With any luck.
With any luck, yes. Quite. If you have the illustration I've used before, and I will continue to use it until I see or hear a satisfactory response. If we were to take two bottles of pop, Mountain Dew, Dr. Pepper, and shake them up and put them on the table here, and they were both fizzing over, it wouldn't occur to any. We couldn't fill the auditorium, first off, and it wouldn't occur to anybody who happened to wander through the auditorium to ask which one of the bottles of pop was winning the debate. They are not debating. They are simply fizzing. They are simply matter in motion. That's all it is a chemical reaction. Now, if there is no God, if the universe is simply matter in motion, if the universe is simply a series of chemical reactions, and we have in our bodies a series of chemical reactions, then we have no reason for believing our thoughts to be true. And that means that we have no reason for believing that our thoughts are chemical reactions. The whole thing collapses on itself. Now, that argument, I think, applies to each one of these things that I'm talking about. It applies to our reasoning capacity. If the universe is simply ultimate chaos, then why would we trust logic? If the universe is ultimate chaos, then what is the basis for morality, goodness? And of interest to me tonight, if there is no God, then how can we possibly say that anything is beautiful or lovely, objectively beautiful or lovely? You can't say anything is objectively true, you can't say anything is objectively good, and you can't say that anything is objectively beautiful. You can tell us what your preferences are, but that's what they are, only preferences. Now, in the short time that we've been doing this tour together, Christopher and I have found out that we have a number of common interests, literature and poetry among them, and the writings of P.G. Woodhouse at the right near the top. We had a good time at lunch yesterday quoting sections out of Woodhouse's work. Woodhouse was a master writer. He was a master of metaphor. He was good at it. But what does that mean in an atheistic universe? What does it mean to say someone is good at it? If someone is good at ballet or good at painting or good at composing concertos, why is that any different from any other concatenation of atoms going on in some other quadrant of the universe? Why do we point to one part of this this little riot of matter and say, that's lovely, that's beautiful, that's good, that should be published, let it go, that should be bought by the art gallery, that should be accepted and promoted and so forth, and this over here is sentimental kitsch, this over here is no good, this over here is not worth the time of day. Well, atheists, of course, make value judgments all the time. They make moral judgments, they make truth claims, and they make aesthetic observations. Christopher is a very gifted writer. He's good at what he does. He's a craftsman. And so I'm not disputing whether or not Christopher seeks to be a good person, or seeks to be a rational person, or seeks to be a wordsmith. I know that he seeks all of those. What I'm looking for is warrant. What is the warrant for that? What is the accounting that you can give of that? Is it possible to say the universe is governed by no God, the universe is meaningless, the universe has no teleology, the universe is going nowhere, but this is lovely, this is beautiful, this is a masterwork? And I don't believe that that's possible to sustain. I don't believe you can maintain objective standards rooted outside our subjective experience in any one of these three areas, whether it's truth, goodness, or beauty. That being the case, what I'd like to do is sort of anticipate an objection and then wrap up. The anticipated objection is one that I've seen an atheist make, that this argument, since the universe is meaningless, any subset of it is meaningless, and rejected as the fallacy of division. The fallacy of division is an informal logical fallacy, not a formal structural fallacy, but an informal logical fallacy, which says that if something is true of the whole, that it must be true of the part. And so the atheist could object, just because the universe is meaningless doesn't mean that this little part of it is meaningless. Well, as an informal fallacy, sometimes informal fallacies are true. Sometimes they are accurate observations, other times they are not. So, for example, if I were to say the Pacific Ocean is made up of salt water, then it follows that this bucket of water from the Pacific Ocean is also salt water. What's true of the whole is true of the part. It's not. It's a fallacy when I say that this the Pacific Ocean taken in its entirety is heavy, therefore a thimble full of water from the Pacific Ocean must also be heavy. No, it's light. That's the fallacy of division in action. So the question is, does the meaninglessness of the universe translate down to the particulars like salt water does with the Pacific Ocean? I believe so. I believe that if there's no teleology, if there's no point, if there's no direction, then that fact haunts you down into all of your endeavors, all of your pursuits, especially concerning your aesthetic pursuits. Anyone who thinks that the history of philosophy has not had an impact on the production of art in our culture, I think, is simply not paying attention. It does translate, and it has, I believe, genuinely aesthetic damaging effects. So, thank you. I'll leave it there.
Well said. My fellow Americans. it's taken me a long time to get to say that. By the way, does anyone here have the nerve to put up their hand and say they know why it's called the World Series? There's always one smart ass. You be quiet for a second. It took me 25 years. I immigrated here 27 years ago. Why do they call it the World Series? It's a game no one else plays. Maybe Dominica, perhaps Haiti, Japan. Okay, Canada, but come on, World Series? What? And it was interesting. Every American I knew said, why wouldn't it be called the World Series? It's our game. You will in a second see where I'm going with this. But I wouldn't accept it. No, though, there must be a reason why it's got that name. And I traced it down. The contest, the event, was sponsored by a newspaper called the New York World. Now defunct. Everything's gone about the New York World. No one remembers it, no one reads it. But the World Series survives as a kind of ghost remnant of this. It could have been called... Could have been called the Post Series, but I don't think Americans would have been so proud of it. I'm only saying, just to begin with, beware of solipsism. As Dr. Oliphant was so kind as to remind you, don't ever think you are the center of the world. Be very careful of assuming that you are the object of a divine design, that there's something special just about being you, that that's all you have to prove. That why wouldn't a person such as yourself have God on their side? Why wouldn't it be? Of course God would care who I slept with, what I ate, what holy day I observed. Why would he not? Surely that's why the heavens are arranged in the starry beauty and array that they, the form they take. And then you read Hamlet's reflections with Yorick at the side of the grave, and you are forced to wonder if maybe, even though it's a less beautiful thought, it could be that the galaxies are not arranged with you in mind. Well, I've already got ahead of myself by not thanking you for having me here, and for not thanking Dr. Oliphant for his extremely warm and generous introduction. When I first published my polemic against theism, I told my publishers I didn't want the conventional New York tour. I didn't want to go to New York, Washington, Chicago, Berkeley, San Francisco, and so forth. I wanted to go to the South, and I wanted to go to colleges that were devout, and I wanted to ask for a challenge wherever I went. And I have to say I've been very impressed and touched by the willingness of people to accept this challenge and to invite this abusive hospitality into their own public. And all I ask in return is that this aisle be permanently named for me. with a large plaque long after I'm gone. All right. The problem of relativism, the problem that Douglas Wilson has been assailing you with, correctly, the problem of saying that really judgment is impossible, that no one value is greater than another, that sub specie aeternitatis, under the eye and scrutiny of heaven, nothing really matters. It doesn't really. Who cares who wins the Second World War? Who cares whether black Americans become full citizens or not? Who minds? Why would we care? Why is that? And is it perhaps something of the aesthetic in ourselves, such as was stated by the great English Romantic poets who did take a side for humanity and for humanism, often, by the way, against theocracy and almost always against religion, when they said, beauty is truth. Truth, beauty, that is all ye know and all ye need to know on earth. Beautiful statement. Once you've heard it, you can't forget it. It ranks to me with another statement made by another great person of the Enlightenment a little earlier, Thomas Jefferson, who says, and once you've heard this, you won't forget it either, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just. He's talking about slavery. It's a beautiful statement, there's no question about it. It also has a certain equilibrium to it, I think you'll agree. And yet, when you think about it for a moment, if there is a just God, what is the need to tremble? If there's a just God, all our concerns are trivial by comparison. Why would we weep? Why would we care? Why would we mind? A just God trumps any possible anxiety or difficulty or crisis we might have. But if there isn't a just God, and there isn't, because the heavens are empty, then you might have to abolish slavery by yourself and not require the divinity and justice of the sublime and the paradisical to do it for you. You'd have to take responsibility. It isn't beautiful to say, no, I don't want the responsibility. I will refer it upward to a supreme, unchallengeable, I would say tyrannical, because unchallengeable and unchangeable, essentially absolutist, I would go as far as to say totalitarian authority. The things that happen to us in this veil of tears will go on happening to us as they did to our predecessors and as they will to our descendants when we are dust. And these things cannot be avoided, and they cannot be referred upwards and outwards to a dictatorial view. Let me give you an example. Let me give you a couple of examples. I wrote a book about the Parthenon. Most objective people would say it's the most beautiful temple of the ancient world, perhaps the most beautiful temple ever built by human hands. Its extraordinary symmetry and harmony makes it quite different from the other temples that claim to conquer death, because the conquest of death is the first thing the barbarian wants to claim, and all barbarian monarchies want to claim. That's why the pyramids are built, to show that death has no power, we'll outlive it. That's why Babylon was built. That's why Karnak was built. All the great temples of the ancient world, when I visit them, strike me with horror. They're built by slaves. Their building is commissioned by slave owners. It's so obvious that they're built to impress, to oppress, to dominate, to grind people down. The Parthenon is lightness and air, and it's open to everybody, and it's a new departure. And though there are terrible things about it, I'll mention some, the cult of Pallas Athena, a fictitious goddess, the Eleusinian mysteries, hocus pocus sprung on the peasantry by Greek priests, the sculpture on the frieze probably shows human sacrifice. We can't be certain of it, but it looks very likely that human sacrifice was going on there, even though Keats wrote so beautifully about that procession in his own a version of truth, beauty, and beauty, beauty being true. But I think the cultural project is this, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, comrades, friends. It's this, the cultural project. Can we rescue, can we separate the beauty, symmetry, harmony, and civilization of pre-Christian, pre-monotheistic, pagan, polytheistic Greece? Can we keep what if that is valuable and useful, philosophical and poetic and dramatic, while dumping the supernatural, the superstitious, the cultish, and of course the Athenian genocidal imperialists that sent expeditions to destroy the whole populations of islands and neighboring republics with which it disagreed, or which didn't which refuse to pay tribute. Yes, I believe it is possible. I believe it is possible in the same sense as I know it's true that even as Verdi wrote his Requiem, he didn't believe in God. He didn't need to believe in God to produce that beautiful music. It isn't true that secularism can't produce a cathedral or an opera. It is true, however, that a secular civilization will have to keep what is valuable of the beauty and symmetry of religious art and devotional architecture while rejecting the supernatural and the superstitious. You see, the supernatural and the superstitious are not the same as the numinous and the transcendent. I don't come before you, atheist and materialist as I am, as someone who simply says that Douglas Wilson and I are two competing bottles of Dr. Pepper. Nor do I come before you as someone who says, I was created out of dust, or as the Quran would say, out of a clot of blood, that I'm an abject serf, that I'm a piece of nothingness fashioned out of garbage by a capricious, tyrannical God. That's an even a worse insult. I'd rather be Dr. Pepper than that, I have to tell you.
Me too.
But now let's contrast the numinous and the transcendent to the superstitious and the supernatural. Francis Collins, my new friend, Christian believer, C.S. Lewis fan, commissioner of the Human Genome Project, great physician, great scientist, great humanitarian. He says, he's a pantheist in effect, I think. He goes on a long hike into the mountains and he comes at one point, I think it's in your home state of Washington, I may be wrong, but I think it's in the Pacific Northwest. He comes to, on his hike, to a point where there's a triune waterfall, a three-in-one waterfall falling and yet arrested in its fall because it's frozen. It's a frozen water trinity. Anyone who understands harmony, symmetry, the beauty of nature will understand what Dr. Collins is seeing. He says, in his own account, at that point when seeing it, I fell to my knees and I accepted Jesus Christ as my personal savior. Some of you may have had similar experiences, I don't know. I'm immune to this kind of thing, but I'm not indifferent to it. Where does he get off with such a non sequitur? It is, of course, very beautiful to see a three-fingered frozen waterfall. What if it had been four fingers and not a trinity? Would he not have accepted Jesus Christ as his personal savior? Did you see the slack-jawed, gaping propaganda of the World Trade Center when everything was all cleared away? At the bottom of the girders, there was a cross standing there. All buildings are built with a crosshatch of steel. It's well known they go like this, like all windows. It would be amazing if there wasn't a cross there. If it was a star and crescent made out of melted steel, I'd be really impressed. And so would the people who blew up the building and want you all to die. If it had been a Star of David, okay, I'd have been slightly impressed too. Only very slightly, for my mother's sake. Now, let's be serious. This stuff is not true, and it's not beautiful, and it's not symmetrical. It is superstition. It is the way the mind searches for form and will find it if it's looking for it, and looks for symbols and looks for miracles and revelations where they're not really there, and is terribly easily satisfied by tiny little bits of pseudo-magic. But if you want to be awe-inspired, ladies and gentlemen, and let me just tell you that those of us who do not believe we are divinely created, let alone divinely supervised, are not immune to the idea of awe and beauty and the transcendent. Let me invite you to look for a moment at the pictures taken by the Hubble telescope. Some of you may have done it. If you haven't done it now, or yet, do it soon. The extraordinary revelations of swirling, yet somehow beautiful new galaxies in color and depth and majesty like nothing I think the human eye has ever seen. Turn away from that if you wish and gaze at a burning bush in an illiterate desert part of the Middle East and say that that's where revelation comes from. I don't believe you'll be able to do it. Or read a page of Stephen Hawking on the absolute magnificence and consistency and underlying beauty. As Einstein says, the great miracle of physics is there are no miracles. It all carries on holding together all the time. There are no interruptions in its order. There are no suspensions of it just to please Joshua or just to please some sect or tribe or group. No, it's much, much, much more impressive than that. I know I've talked for a little too long, but I'm going to do this if it kills me. Hawking has a colleague who looked at the event horizon of the black hole. Do you know what I'm talking about? You know what a black hole is, at any rate. If you could travel towards a black hole, not yet possible to do, if you could, in theory, the event horizon is the point at which the black hole is pulling everything into itself. So over into the black hole goes light itself. It's so strong it can pull light back into itself. It's really awe-inspiring. A lot more, say, than a crowd of pigs infested by devils running down a hill into the sea, which is a piece of sorcery and cheap magic of the sort that shouldn't impress any thinking person. Think about a black hole instead. Pulling the light into itself, the event horizon just reorganizing nature. So that if you could get to that lip, the lip of that event horizon, and fall in, go in, you could, in theory, see the past and the future stretching before and in front of you. You would see time, except you wouldn't have the time to do it, of course, if you were a mere primate, as we are. But Hawking has a colleague who says if he knew he was dying of a terminal illness, that's how he'd want to go out, is over the lip of the event horizon. That would be majesty. That would be magnificence. That would be awe-inspiring. That would be apocalyptic. So it's in the natural world, it's in the world of science and the world of innovation and discovery and doubt. We wouldn't have discovered any of these things if we'd taken the religious story for granted to begin with. We would have said we already know enough. We know. God made this. God wants it this way. What's the need for inquiry? We already have all the information we need. The big difference between this side of the house, mine, and the other, is this. I am absolutely certain that I do not know, but that it might be possible to find out, and that doubt and skepticism and innovation and inquiry are the only means by which wonder and beauty and awe and symmetry will be discovered, and beyond those peaks we can yet see, new, more wonderful peaks will rise. Whereas, on the Wilson side of the house, it is said, we already have the certainty. We know that God created us, and we even claim to know his mind and what he wants of us. And I just invite you to open your minds to the possibility that the skeptical and the inquiring and the doubtful will be better than anything that calls itself faith. Because anything that calls itself faith calls itself certainty. And for certainty, I think there is no place in an institute of intellectual mentation and higher education. And I'm very grateful to you all for giving me the chance to say so. Thank you.
All right. I believe the drill was to interact for a little bit and then closing statements. I would like to make a couple of quick observations and then ask a few questions. The observation would be, Christopher and I were talking this morning about whether I believed in the miracle of the Gadarene swine that you referred to, and I certainly do. I accept all the miracles of the Bible, as described in the Bible, but I mentioned to him the Gadarene swine rule, which is just because a group is in formation, that doesn't mean they know where they're going. The other thing that I would like to point out about that is that it's not an either-or thing. It's not as though by believing that Jesus did a miracle with the Gadarene swine, that I'm thereby prohibited from believing that there are marvels to be seen through the Hubble telescope. I'm not forced to choose one or the other. I believe that marvels occur on the grand cosmic scale, and marvels occur at levels much smaller than what occurred with the Gadarene swine. So just God is a macrocosmic God, and God is a microcosmic God. He speaks in the great things, and he speaks in the little things. The difficulty here, well, one other thing about this. When you think about crossing over the event horizon into a black hole, and you get to the point where you see the future and the past at the same time, or you think about quantum mechanics and things traveling like a particle and arriving like a wave, or vice versa, or the same thing, you know, they're both at the same time, that sort of thing. The thing that astonishes me when I read physicists, particularly atheistic fellows who are of evoking a sense of wonder out of their descriptions of these sorts of things, and you heard Christopher just do it, they then turn around and say that they have objections to the doctrine of the Holy Trinity because they can't make sense of it. Does it make sense to you that you could see the past and the future at the same time, provided you were headed toward a big black hole of nothing? Would you sketch that for me on the blackboard, please? Well, of course.
That could be done. The Trinity can't be done in that way.
Ah, sure. I'd triangle in a circle. So, the point...
How do you do it?
Now, the point is that there are mysteries beyond us, right? The issue is not whether there are things in the universe that will stagger us and make us go, whoa. The issue is when you reflect on what you think is actually going on, when you reflect on what is actually going on, and you say there's no purpose in this, there's no design behind it, it's just a plain, weird, crazy place, I believe that you have removed the aesthetic element. You've removed the element of intention. It may be big, it may be crazy, it may be wild, it may be chaotic, but it's not lovely. But if it is designed by God, in other words, if all those galaxies that you can see through the Hubble pictures, if all those galaxies, if the Crab Nebula and all of those things were put there on purpose by the triune God of Scripture, then you have not only something that's grand and big in scope, but you have intentionality. You have what I would call artistry. God is a great artist. Now, here's the difficulty. When Christopher and this will lead up to my question.
Yes.
When you began with why would he care, why would God care, why should I take a solipsistic approach and assume that God would care who I slept with? Well, if I said, why would he care who I, and then I drew a blank, it's not just, it cannot, you could fill it in with more than who I slept with or who I lusted after in my heart. You could fill it in with who I killed, whose family's village I destroyed, whose nation I blew up because I felt like it, whose nation and tribe I enslaved because it just seemed like the thing to do at the time. Christopher said, when we discover that we are not accountable, that we can't, we have no court of appeals that goes up to the top with this totalitarian God as Christopher sees him, I see a father, he sees Big Brother, what it boils down to. So I see a loving father, and he sees the eternal surveillance cameras and that kind of thing. And he says,
And thought crime.
Thought crime, right. And you have, exactly so. So you have, you said, if there is no God there, we might have to abolish slavery by ourselves, right? And here's my question. Why wouldn't you say, we would have to abolish slavery ourselves or not?
Well, indeed, the or not is always pregnant there, just as in your remarks just now about how God might care about more than just who you slept with. I was picking a trivial example. Or, by the way, in what position you did so, or on what holy day. You wanted to make
or,
it more...
Or he killed them afterwards.
You wanted to make it more serious and said, what about who I kill? Well, as no one here doesn't know, there are biblical mandates for killing, and indeed for the killing of nations, and for the killing of tribal groups, and for the killing of all their children so that their name be blotted out, and for, in the case of some luckier groups than the Amalekites, keeping only their young women alive so that, for purposes better imagined than described, so that there is a divine mandate for killing. You can be told what to do, and religion is obedience to the divine law. It isn't to say you would behave as an ordinary moral person would expect to behave with a divine warrant to do so. No. As any Mormon will tell you, if the head of his church tells him to commit a murder, he has to assume that the head of that church knows better than he does, that it might be for a much higher reason.
But why are we having this?
He would do something that no morally sane person would do because he was religious. Now, let us not lose sight of this point, which you have, in our previous discussion, several times conceded. If God wanted you to do it, you wouldn't ask the ordinary moral questions. And we know that there are biblical warrants for slavery and for genocide. And so your point that that religion conforms to ordinarily understood humanitarianism simply falls. That's the first thing.
So my question is this, because I don't see us really disagreeing at this point. I believe that it was okay to kill Amalekites, right? Because it was not okay to not do it, because God told them to kill the Amalekites. We would differ
on... Well, there you are. I got you to say it.
Okay. Happy to say it, and didn't get me to say it.
No, I know. I know you get a bang out of saying it.
What I actually get a bang out of is what I'm going to get you to say next. And that is, neither one of us has a problem with killing Amalekites. I don't have a problem with it because God told him to do it. You don't have a problem with it because the universe just doesn't care what happens to Amalekites.
No, actually, that's not true, because what if I was an Amalekite?
Well, you're not the universe.
Well, no, I'm sorry. It still changes everything.
No, it doesn't. Because you're not an Amalekite. They're all dead. They're all dead.
That is what relativism means. You know, don't you, that it actually is true. There are discussions among Israeli rabbis, including Israeli rabbis in the Israeli army, published in Israeli newspapers today, say, is the commandment to kill the Amalekites applicable to the Palestinian Arabs, Christian and Muslim, or not? Is Amalek still with us? Is he the name of our enemy? Are we still enjoined by God to destroy all non-Jews in the greater Palestine? This stuff goes on.
And if they answer it in the affirmative, you don't mind.
This is why I feel justified in the subtitle of my book, that to no argument does religion add anything that doesn't make it more toxic. Now, we wandered a little from the symmetrical and the beautiful point, didn't we? But perhaps you... Oh, the gathering. I did have something, because you challenged me on the gathering.
Yes.
If you believe in all these miracles, it's entirely up to you. There are some miracles I wish were true. The first one is the best. Changing water into wine for a wedding works for me, and also shows, I think, a concession by Judeo-Christianity to the influence of Hellenism in the region, which was still quite strong. As you know, the Passover Seder consists really of people lying around on couches, drinking wine, asking questions dialectically in a Socratic manner, bringing the children into the discussion and so forth. That's an admirable tradition on which to base things. I think not enough of Judaism, and certainly not enough of Christianity, is based on that method, but at least the miracle of Cana shows they knew the importance of wine, and they knew they wouldn't sell their religion without that. But the gathering swine worries me. There may be a woman who's possessed by demons and devils. I don't think such a thing could possibly happen. I don't think women are, or anyone is, demonically or diabolically possessed. The Prophet Muhammad believes that our world is surrounded by demons and jinns. That they're around us all the time. Devils are in the dust, are in the air. The wind. Some very primitive animist tribes believe this too. No decent thinking person can believe it. And even if it was to be the case that a woman was possessed by a demon, you can't make the demon go away by making it go and infect a group of pigs in order to make them commit suicide. I mean, in other words, that miracle, if it were true, wouldn't be worth having. It would be a claim that your prophet was a vulgar sorcerer, or was at least trying to impress his followers with vulgar witchcraft and sorcery. I leave that point to you, but to say that's either true or beautiful seems to me to blaspheme both terms quite badly.
The difficulty with taking the miracle that way, the fellow involved was named Legion. It was a guy, not a lady. And the pigs were an unclean animal for the Jews. And when Jesus cast the demons out, if you think of it in terms of a simple wonder worker who's out there stupefying the peasants, and you take it as a petty miracle that way, that, whoa, he killed the pigs, then, of course, I think you've got a point. The miracle is tawdry and overdone, if that's all you understand it to be. But the story ends, it's quite striking, with the people in that village couldn't keep this guy bound. He was he lived in the tombs, and when Jesus cast the demons out of him and the pigs were killed, the people begged Jesus to leave that region. They preferred the devil they knew to the devil they didn't know. I think there's a commentary being made on the state of the spiritual health and spiritual vibrancy in Israel at that time. They didn't want Jesus there messing with the arrangements that they had made, with the accommodations they had made. So if you simply assume
with
that...
With their demon-haunted world.
Correct. In other words, Jesus was... What Jesus did was he traveled around casting out demons. And what many people don't realize is that demonism, shamanism, this sort of thing that you encounter still in many parts of the world, that sort of thing was banished, exiled, defeated, and overcome precisely by the Christian faith. If you're encountering witch doctors and people who are living in bondage to that kind of thing, whether it's made up as you believe or genuine as I believe, or what is more likely, a mixture of both. I believe that there's a great deal of superstition mingled in with genuine spiritual problems. If you believe that, then you say, let's look at the scoreboard. Let's look at what has happened, where the Christian faith has gone. We have been instrumental as Christians in lifting the clouds of superstition. What you glory in, the Enlightenment, I don't think was possible in witchcraft-riddled societies. I think it was dependent on the Christian faith.
Okay. It's my turn to ask a question, isn't it, I think?
Yes.
I'm going to stay on this point, too. Yeah. But by way of preface, Senator John McCain has just nominated as his running mate a woman who attends a church in which spiritual warfare and anti-demon tactics are regularly discussed, has been filmed having hands laid on her by what I would describe as an animist bishop from Kenya, she may describe as a Christian, who talks about the witches he's expelled from his own area of the highlands of Kenya. So how can you say that Christianity has rid us of the nonsensical idea of witchcraft, demonism, and exorcism? To the contrary, it's the reason why these nonsensical, barbaric, primitive ideas survive. Now, I hope I don't take advantage of you if I tell the audience, with your permission,
oh, sure,
of a question I asked you yesterday and the answer you gave me. I asked Douglas Wilson this. Suppose that a soul, I'll call it a soul for his sake, a person is born in Saudi Arabia today into the Wahhabi theocratic society. Would you rather that person became an atheist or joined the majority religion of that state? You want to tell them your answer?
I'd prefer he become an atheist.
Yeah. I thought it was a very honorable reply on your part, and I want to press it a little bit. Do you believe that Thomas Aquinas, called a saint by the Roman Catholic Church, levitated and flew all around the nave of Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris?
I'm afraid you lost me. I'm a good Protestant.
Right. Yeah. I don't believe it either.
Right. Yeah.
You don't think that's true? Do you think that Muhammad took a night journey on a horse from the Arabian Peninsula to the Dome of the Rock in Jerusalem, and the horse left a hoofprint before rocketing him up to paradise?
I'm not with that one.
I don't
either.
Think so. No. So here's my question: How can you manage to say that miracles are only true when they're Calvinist? Because it's always seemed to me, as a secularist, never mind an atheist, that either all religions' supernatural claims must be true, or none of them are, my own position, or only one of them is. The least probable position of all.
Right.
The one you've decided to occupy. Why is it that the miracle claims are okay made by Calvinists and not by Muslims, other kinds of Christian,
notice
or
the,
Jews?
Notice the structure of your argument. The structure of your argument is that...
Glad you think it's got a structure.
Well, it does, and here it is. The structure of your argument is that you're reasoning from the existence of counterfeits to a denial of the genuine article. I believe that there are plenty of spurious Federal Reserve notes printed up by counterfeiters in their basement. And I believe that this assertion that this bogus Thomas Aquinas $20 bill and bogus Islamic flying horse $20 bill does not obligate me in the slightest to deny the existence of genuine currency. I don't see how you can argue from the existence of counterfeits and fakes and knockoffs to a denial of the genuine.
But I wasn't doing so.
You were asking
No, I was asking how on what you found your assertion that yours is the only true bill.
The ones I believe in are the ones I believe in.
Yes. For example, I've spent a lot of time on a small point that I think is a big one. You probably, or some of you, will know of the existence of a text called The Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion. It was originally fabricated by Christian Russian Orthodox fascists in the pay of the Tsar to try and condemn the Jewish people for a blood libel and a secret government based on conspiracy. And it's now the chief paranoid document on the website of Hamas and Islamic Jihad. And it's had a huge circulation in Christian and Muslim religious circles for a very long time. It's usually described as a forgery. If you've ever read about it, you'll have heard of it as a forgery. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it may seem to you a pedantic point, but I don't think it is. Whenever I write about it, I say, don't call it a forgery. Why not? A forgery is a copy of a true document. Mm-hmm. Protocols of the Elders of Zion is not a copy of a true document.
Right.
It is a fabrication. It's a whole cloth hoax. It's a criminal slander invented out of whole cloth. There's nothing forged about it at all. There's no true bill to begin with. Now do you see the distinction?
Yes.
Well, why are your miracles the true bill and the others are all copies of it?
Because they happened. Jesus really did.
All right.
Jesus really did rise from the dead, which I believe on the same basis.
Well, Aquinas believed that.
Sure.
Muhammad believes
the fact
some
that,
of that
Aquinas didn't fly around Notre Dame does not mean that he got everything wrong.
No.
Right. So. I believe that I was not there at the Battle of Waterloo, didn't see it happen. I accept it on the basis of eyewitness accounts and authorities, accounts that I deem to be reliable. I do the same thing with George Washington crossing the Delaware. I do the same thing with the resurrection of Jesus from the dead. Now, I believe that you could generate a whole host of Protestant, evangelical Protestant miracles that I don't believe in either. I believe that we ought to study it, love the Lord our God with all our heart, soul, mind, and strength, love the Lord our God with all our brains. We should look at the evidence and make a determination. We shouldn't just say, oh, it's a miracle, it's good, and it serves the cause of the gospel, or it helps keep people in line, or helps inspire them. If it's not true, if it didn't happen, we should have nothing to do with it. And I've been in Christian circles for many years, and I've heard all kinds of miracle stories that I don't believe. I've heard probably more miracle stories that I don't believe than miracle stories I do believe. But as a Christian, I don't believe that I can go into the Bible and pick and choose. If Jesus did not rise from the dead, then we of all men are most to be pitied. And so it doesn't matter how socially good it is or bad from your point of view. What matters is the truth. And so when I say I believe this miracle occurred, it has nothing to do with, I don't accept Hume's argument as an absolute, you know, that you can just rule miracles out. I believe on the basis of well-attested miracles with eyewitnesses you believe, that's the most rational thing you can do.
I was about to stop and say no further questions, but it's not fair to the great Scotsman to say that Hume said all miracles could be ruled out. He simply said you have to ask yourself, if you appear to see the laws of nature being suspended in front of your eyes, which is more likely, that they've been suspended in your favor or that you are under a misapprehension?
Right. And one
of those, you're not allowed to appoint your own senses, your own impressions, as the arbiter of the natural order. And that might lead in the end to a dismissal, but it isn't an a priori one.
Sure. And I believe that Joseph, when he found out that Mary, his betrothed, was pregnant, he followed David Hume's advice to the letter. And he didn't know what the most reasonable explanation was. And it's not that in the ancient world it's not that people didn't know where babies came from. It's not that they didn't know that you couldn't walk on water. It's not that they didn't know that you couldn't change water to wine. They knew that as well as we do.
No, all Joseph knew was who hadn't made her pregnant.
Right.
If we have to be crude about this.
Correct.
And if you were David Hume, you would ask, which is more likely, that the fact that he hasn't made her pregnant and she is the result of divine intervention, or that a Jewish girl could tell a fib?
Sure. And Joseph...
Now, of the two, I don't think the latter is overwhelmingly improbable.
Sure. And Joseph was
and
right with
no
David
religion,
Hume.
No religion has ever been founded except with the claim that its founder and prophet was born of a virgin. I have the whole list in the front of my book, if anyone... By the way, available at fine bookstores everywhere. I have in the first two pages of my book a list. There is no religion from Aztec to Hindu, including Buddhism, where the Gautama is born through a slit in his mother's side, where it doesn't begin with a miraculous birth.
And there's no counterfeit money.
You couldn't be in the religion business without claiming that, especially in the Greater Jerusalem area.
You couldn't be in the counterfeit. And you couldn't be in the counterfeiting business without green paper and numbers in the corner.
And the Quran absolutely attests it. The Quran attests the virginity and motherhood of Mary.
Sure.
It's in the Quran. What could be wrong with that?
Nobody counterfeits brown Safeway shopping bags. They're not worthwhile. It's not worth it to counterfeit them. If something's worthwhile, you've got a genuine article, then you've got counterfeits.
Okay, now, pretty soon we're going to have to see if we've exhausted the tolerance of our brothers and sisters. But you know what? You remind me of something. Douglas and I had lunch yesterday with Marvin Olasky. Probably some of you know him. He's now the president of the King's College in New York and was once famed as the head of President Bush's faith-based initiative. Dr. Olasky and I have something in common. We both used to be members of Marxist organizations, and we were chatting a bit about our old allegiances. Now, I remember I.F. Stone saying about Mussolini calling himself a socialist and Hitler calling himself a national socialist. He said, that's a compliment of a kind, said my old comrade, Red Comrade, as he said, nobody bothers to counterfeit bad currency. Well, it turns out that they do.
But not currency believed to be.
It turns out that things, the ironies of history and the cruelties that reality practice on us as a suffering species, yes, actually, people will go to great lengths to say, I'd like to deal in this bankrupt currency. It can happen. And it has, as you've just shown.
Yes, people do.
Well, we don't have a chairman, do we? So when do we know when to invite our guests to join us?
When do we know?
I would forego mine for the sake of questioner, if you would.
Sure, I'm happy to.
No one will think I've said too little, will they? But I've dodged the responsibility.
You can tell who's in charge here. And it's not me.
My dear chap.